Welcome to Talking Paper. I'm Christian Needon. For this episode, I speak with writer and artist Dallas Athent about her new book of poetry, Theomania, out now from Anti-Sentimental Society. In addition to her own poetic work, Athent volunteers her time promoting the work of other writers by coordinating East Coast reading events, along with myself, for literary nonprofit Nomadic Press. I began this Talking Paper interview by asking Athent about the creation of Theomania.
Theomania is a collaboration between the artist Maria Pavlovska and myself. I had written these poems in an existential crisis, and I was a huge fan of her art. And I came to her one day and said, you know, I feel like your art goes with what I've been experiencing mentally here, and I think it would be a good collaboration. And she, being a very direct and dramatic person, right away said, of course. And it was like not even a question for her, where it's like I'm questioning everything all the time. So it ended up working out pretty well. And we went to a few publishers, and the publisher of this is Anti-Sentimental Society. It's a new imprint from Off the Park Press. And two of the people who co-founded Off the Park Press / Black Square Editions were familiar with my work, and when I brought the project to them, they were very excited, specifically Ronna Lebo, and Bonnie Joy also helped edit it, so it ended up working, even though the whole thing when I started writing the poems was not something I ever expected anyone to look at.
How far along in that process did the all-encompassing title of Theomania come to you?
Theomania is a actual Platonic theory, or I say Platonic theory because I'm always thinking about the elements since I work in tarot cards, but it's a theory by Plato, which is that you are most susceptible to make good work when you are in a state of crisis. And that crisis, whether it's being heartbroken or going through the catharsis of being man, brings you closer to the divine because you're so aware of the darkness of what it means to be mortal that you birth something that is more divine out of that in an effort to be connected to a greater meaning and get you out of that dark place. So it's why we say that blues singers and jazz singers and people who make rock and roll and Basquiat and all of these people who have experienced something really dark have been able to make such great work.
Tell me about the crises that inspired this.
I always felt growing up that I was an artist or a writer or something that was beyond this provincial suburban life that was prescribed to me, especially being a young girl. You know, I remember watching the Rocky Horror Picture Show and tearing my t-shirts up and redesigning them with safety pins and all that stuff as a teenager that a lot of us angsty kids go through. But I think that underneath it all, it wasn't just about me being angsty. It was about me understanding there was something beyond this world that we have grown up in that I was sort of just existing within and trying to understand how many different experiences people throughout the world might have that were different than my own.
Speaking to that idea of identity, page one of Theomania has the words degenerate deity. Why?
So there's this idea when you study the Platonic elements or tarot cards or anything that's esoteric, that there's dark and there's light, right? Like, we even know that in the simple concept of yin and yang. And for me, the idea of Theomania is trying to be connected to something that's holy through art. But with that comes this understanding that we are mortal and accepting that and also relishing in the beauty of mortality. So the degenerate deity part is about being an alcoholic, being broke, being somebody who understands they don't understand anything at all, and accepting the fact that we're all going to die.
How much
did your own age play into that? Did approaching 30 in this society, in this city, have a role?
You know, that's actually a good question because I'm 29 now when this book came out, but I started writing these things when I was 26 and 27. But even at that stage, I remember when I turned 19 and I thought to myself, this is my last year as a teenager, and being a young girl, that felt like it meant something. It felt like it meant my youth was over, which is ridiculous. But I think that for girls especially, age means something because we are valued by our youth often. I don't feel that way now. I don't think it had any effect on what I did here. I dropped a lot of those issues in my mid-20s, but it is interesting that you brought it up because I think it's something that a lot of people think about, but especially girls. And I don't want anyone to think that life ends in your mid-20s. I hope it doesn't.
And the other side of that question, obviously, is the role of New York City. It's a recurring motif, elements of New York City in this, but also the role of being a girl, being a woman in New York City. Tell me about that aspect.
I was always fascinated with New York growing up. I grew up in the suburbs outside of New York, and when you grow up in the suburbs, you're like, oh, there's something more than this. Like, this can't be everything. These picket fences, these golden retrievers, like this lemonade in the Crate and Barrel jar. Like, it's just, you know there's more. You know there's more than the PTA meetings. So it meant a lot to me to move here and to see all of these different ways to live and these different aspects of life and a lot of things that weren't pretty. And a lot of me relished in it because it made me feel infinite to know there were so many ways I could live my own life, but also that there were so many things I would never understand as being a mere mortal. So it's humbling and yet it's uplifting all at the same time because you realize you can do anything, but you can't do everything. And especially as a young girl, there's this pressure to use your youth to get yourself ahead while you can, because it's easy to do that in a place where there's a lot of influential men who are looking to young girls. But I was trying to look beyond that and say, I'm a young girl, but I can do anything I want, and also accept I can't do everything.
Speaking of accomplishments, this is not your first time publishing a book. Your previous work was as editor of Bushwick Nights, a collection of short stories working with Bushwick Daily, correct?
Yeah, so I had a book of short stories come out with Bushwick Daily a couple of years ago, and I was really happy about the project at the time. We got a lot of really good press, more than I could have hoped for, not really having been published anywhere before. And we sold thousands of copies, which I thought was really impressive. I was happy myself. So it was also a gift for a publishing company to come to me with this and say they were going to handle the marketing and the distribution and all of that. Because when I worked with Bushwick Daily, I did all of the distribution since they weren't a publishing company. At the same time, it's sort of like you always feel like you could do more.
I want to ask you about yet another project that you did, because it lives on in your social media handle, Chicks on the HUD.
Yeah.
What is the project that inspired that handle?
So Chicks on the HUD, it's my Instagram, it's my email, I'll never change it. It's my Twitter handle. Chicks on the HUD is a derivative of the first book I ever wrote, which I self-published. But it hasn't actually been published by anyone. I only did like I think 150 copies. It was a very small printing. But I wrote the book. It's called Chicken on the Hudson. And it takes place in dozens of neighborhoods in New York. So each chapter takes place in a different neighborhood in New York. And I'm talking about all five boroughs. And I wrote this when I was in my very early 20s, I want to say 21 and 22, and I didn't know anyone. And I was an artist at that point. I was a fashion designer and a painter, but I was too poor after the recession to do either of those things. So to be creative, I decided to write a book. And that's really how I became a writer. I didn't go to school or any of that. I wrote this book and I'm still very happy with it. I think one day I would love for it to have an editor and somebody to fully revamp it into what it could be. Because when I wrote it, it was very experimental. And I think it would be hard for a lot of people to get through it based off of sheer inspiration. But with an editor, I feel like it could really be something.
And again, in the name On the Hudson, it's very grounded again in New York. But your collaborator on this project, at least in her origins, it's very non-New York, even though she now lives in New York, Maria Pavlovska. Tell me how this collaboration came to be, and what does she bring to Theomania?
So Maria is a painter that does mostly black and white abstract paintings. Sometimes she uses a little bit of red. She's from Macedonia. Her paintings are extremely dramatic, very violent, very rooted in dualities of light and dark. And the thing I appreciated about her work was that her work isn't about the final outcome. She's not trying to make her work look like anything in particular. A painting isn't set out to have a specific end goal that she makes. Instead, it's about the process of her actually making the art. So sometimes you see splatters, sometimes you see numbering, sometimes you see geometric shapes, other times you see none at all. Sometimes you see scratches out, like she'll etch out of what she's already painted and take something from a negative space. And to me, that went with the goal of the book, which was to illustrate the process one goes through in an existential crisis.
And moreover, you actually went out to visit Maria in Macedonia and got a little bit of a taste of the artist community that she sprang from out there. What was that like?
I have to say, Macedonia is the most east I've ever been in my life. I want to say maybe at this point I've been to 8 countries, which really isn't that many if you think about the fact that there's, 195 in the world. I still feel very lucky to have gone to 8 countries, or maybe it's 10. I don't really know. But it's still the most east I've ever been. And that means that it's the furthest away from what I know. And in that, I found a great distance from the capitalistic mentality we have here about showmanship with sales. So there were a lot of artists, you know, it's not a particularly wealthy nation, but there were a lot of artists, and each of them were inviting us into their homes. And they were showing us how proud they were of their work. And because they didn't seem, and, you know, I was only there for a week, so I feel even presumptuous to say all of this based off of what I experienced. But nonetheless, they didn't seem too concerned about who I was or what I could do for them. They were just fully within their work. And I saw some of the best work I've ever seen in my life. And one thing that I thought was really cool was that the artists there were challenging themselves by trying something new all of the time. Here we seem to pinpoint a look, something that a collector could easily recognize and sell so that other people could recognize that work and deem it worth something. Whereas there, you weren't necessarily able to look at somebody's body of work and say with a finite authority that it was by the same artist. People were trying new things just to try them, which I thought was really cool.
There's a third collaborator on Theomania who makes her mark on the experience of reading this book, and that's Eve Siegel. Tell me about her contribution.
So Eve is actually my aunt. She's also my godmother. And she is very established book designer. She does a lot of textbooks. She does a lot of history books. And I went to her asking if she was open to something that was more experimental and if she could lend us her talent. And she said yes. And I have to say that I didn't have a vision. Nobody had a vision for how it would look when it came out. And I swear within 2 weeks, she was able to churn this out to where the words mimicked the images of the drawing in a way that made it an art book and made it something beyond what any of us had imagined. And so without that input, it wouldn't have been the same.
Let's talk a little bit deeper about a few of the poems in Theomania, starting with this poem.
People have been riding the path train forever. Watch me crawl in a hole. I'm from the Mediterranean. Driveway stone lions are my family. I date at the park and the palace. Get drunk in the comfort of couches. Take a train to the city. As points out by dropping a wink. Sex and we don't usually do this. Compliment a mom on her cooking. Buy a leopard print something. Develop a crush on his friend. Feel lonely looking at skylines. Wish this dinner was from me to you. Blast some good old Sinatra. Doobie 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 doo.
Tell me a little bit about it. What inspired it?
I was coming back from Jersey City. I was actually coming back from a show at the Jersey City Theater Center where you joined me, I believe, along with Rana. So the three of us were there. And when I was on the PATH train, I was thinking about being a girl from the suburbs of New York. And, you know, I grew up in Connecticut and I'm very familiar with Westchester, but here I was in New Jersey. And it was sort of just about the general things a lot of us go through and how we feel that that might hopefully one day connect us with a higher power. So there's a lot of mortal things in here about drinking, sinking into a couch, wearing leopard print, but also the idea that this is a mantra that will somehow connect us with the divine.
Let's take a look at another.
This here, this is all the mania that I can take. Sign of the cross and some eggs on your plate makes you feel alive because you're here and I'm here and we all need to know our worth. There's just so many ways to do it, so many ways to live. There's headaches for the millions, for the drinker and sad souls whose time will make another round the world like we sure care where we are, where we call home. I thought things and told myself I was an artist. I felt things and thought I was an artist. I saw my world my way, called it art, threw things up on the wall and let everyone know I made them. So this here, this is all the tough love that I can stand. Do a sign of the cross and a prayer that I'll clean up tomorrow. That I'll decide to be the kind that does the dishes and shows up on time. That I'll learn to love the mundane in a beautiful world. Because there's just so many ways to do it, so many ways to live. So why mess around anymore? The purpose of art is horror.
The purpose of art is horror. A lot of people have asked me about what that means and what this poem means. I think that the main lines here is I thought things and told myself I was an artist. I felt things and thought I was an artist. I saw my world my way, called it art, threw things up on the wall and let everyone I know I made them. And really what it is it's about the duality of trying to be an artist and function in today's world, or any world really, and flip-flopping back and forth between having to be mortal and immortal. And so the point of the end of it saying the purpose of art is horror is that the purpose of art is something you can never achieve.
Indeed. Let's take a look at another.
So the last one I'm going to really talk about is one that was also published in Packet Biweekly, which is a biweekly that you can pick up from MoMA PS1 that's edited by Nicole Reber. and a couple of other people, but Nicole's just the person I happen to have met, and she's an incredible artist. She's a text artist. She's amazing. I saw her work at a show, and I told her I thought she was incredible. And I sent her some of my work, and this is one of the things they had published in Packet.
So much anxiety. I can't even swallow. Everything is a lump. Everything is a bump in the road. Just how do you expect me to sleep tonight? The terrors, the terrors. What could happen? Anything, everything. But let's be honest, nothing would be worse of all. Threaten a fortress, don't take what I built. White rice means the world to me. I feel powerful and then powerless. It's like I own everything and then not a thing. This is the downfall of an artist. Then I wonder what things do for us anyway. Things make us feel like our life is something to be envied. Things make us feel like we have control. Things make us feel like we don't need to feel at all because there are no holes.
This is actually the same point as the other poem. It's the exact same point. There's nothing different to take away from this. It's just a different way of saying it. But it's still just that duality of being an anxious mortal and also trying to build something that will live beyond you.
On a note of posterity, if you wouldn't mind turning to the final page of Theomania and just reading the final paragraph there, the repeated, we are.
We are minding our split ends, trimming them one by one. We are carrying drugs for him in the rucksack. We are deciding between a drink and a cupcake. We are choosing that perfect shade of pink. We are debating getting that blouse at the store. We are wondering if we should pregnancy or YOLO. We are eating tuna fish salad at a cafe. We are switching from flats to heels and geisha. We are switching back to flats after heels prove too cumbersome. We are kicking ourselves for forgetting the tampons. We are crying because he hurt our friend and we love her. We are telling ourselves we're better off on our own. We are installing and uninstalling dating apps. We are biting our nails at work and then getting them done. We are pulling our knees in on the subway. We are leaving names behind in the stalls. So yes, we are sisters, but don't think because we are one. Not so easy, and don't try to hold down Dallas, because whatever we are doing, I have lions on my shoulders. I told you, I'm my only self. I am everything.
Why did you choose to make that the final poem in Theomania?
There's this thing about me, and then there's this thing about girls as a whole. So the thing about girls as a whole is that whole we are section is these things that we're told we have to do or things that we're expected to do. And I'm trying to contradict that for women, but I'm also trying to contradict myself against everything I've ever been told to do, whether I'm a girl or not. So I think that with everything I do, I give myself a lot of credit because I speak up very loudly, and I've never been a person who has not tried something because it might embarrass me or it might make me look bad or make me unpopular. And I'm thinking about all of the pressure put on women as a whole and how I've had to come out of that, but also how other women have had to come out of that. But then I'm also just thinking of myself as a human being, aside from being a woman, and how whether I was a girl or not, I still stand up for things more than I think most men I know do. So it was just very, I think, important for me to illustrate the fact that I live the life I live because I'm a girl, especially one with chronic illnesses and, you know, my own issues there. But that even if that's the case, I'm still going to be me and I'm not going to allow anything to stop me.
You mentioned before that mortality does play a role in the themes of these poems. How does your own health issues play into your own idea of mortality in your own life?
I mean, I think about the fact that I'm going to die constantly. And I don't say that in like a depressing way, like, oh, I'm going to die. But I live with an illness where my body literally shuts down at least once a day, chronically, where at the very tip of the iceberg, I experience what it means for a body to shut down and get closer to that place where we're all going to end up. So I don't think about death as in death. I think about death as in life. Because every moment I have feels, I don't want to say like a gift, because that's like cheesy and the universe owes us nothing. Every moment I have feels like an opportunity.
And it's fitting then that this book is published under the Anti-Sentimental Society. You found two very important allies, it seems, in Ronna Lebo and Bonnie Joy, two former guests of this program. Tell me about them as artists. Tell me about them as editors, publisher, collaborators.
You know, I really respect them both. I really respect both of their writing. Ronna, as a poet, is very good about illustrating the darkness of man and their desires and the fucked up things that they do and calling them out on it and just accepting it for that fact. If you read Prolapse, she has some very accurate characteristics, I think, of various people that she's able to illustrate without judgment. Bonnie, on the other hand, recently has gotten into very scientific writing, but reading her work from the book that was published by Black Square Editions, I believe the correct title is Before, During, and After Rainstorms. In that book, she illustrates the enlightenment from doing very mundane everyday things, which I think is wonderful. So I have found them both to be extremely inspirational. I can honestly say without either of them, this wouldn't have happened, but particularly Ronna, from the moment I met her, seeing that there might have been something worth in this pile of shit I was writing, I have to give her a huge thanks for that. I really do. I really do. I sent her my stuff at a point where, looking back on it, I am almost embarrassed.
And as editors, what was it like working with people editing poetry that was obviously so personal to you?
You know, Bonnie actually did most of the editing. And I sat down with her one night at Think Coffee in Chelsea, and we were there for like a couple hours. And she had read every word, and she had markups all over the book. It wasn't just like she grazed by and was like, I think you could do X, Y, and Z. No, she really, really went through everything, which it's not very often you have somebody who's been published the way she has, who has, you know, a master's in this area from such a prestigious university, who's willing to help you like that. And I went through everything and I made most of the edits that she suggested because she was right. And it wasn't stressful. It really wasn't. It wasn't something I had to think twice about because she really saw the work for what it was. And she was able to say, you know, why did you capitalize these letters but not these letters? You need to be consistent here so that when people open the next page, they know what to expect out of you and they know what voice you're trying to give them. And every criticism she gave came with a reason and an understanding.
And sticking with Black Square Editions, Anti-Sentimental Society, and Theomania for that matter, what's poetry's place in the current publishing market? And why do you think it's important that it continues to have a place for readers in the arts, to have that shelf space that people can find it?
You know, I'm probably going to get in a lot of trouble for this, but I'm not sure it is important it has a space because it's so unreachable. And I tried to write this, but also my other work in a way that I would hope somebody somewhere would be able to reach it. But I read a lot of modern poetry from my peers who are esteemed and they deserve respect, and many of them are talented. But more than half the time, I don't understand what the fuck they're talking about. I really don't. And I talk to a lot of people who read books, you know, just general people, and they don't get it either. And it's not like people aren't reading. They're reading. They're reading articles. They're reading personal essays. They're reading novels. But poetry used to be a little more of a narrative, and it wasn't trying to put people through mental gymnastics to try to detect what they're trying to say. And I think as long as the trend extends that way, it is going to be this elitist MFA culture of entangled words that only people who have studied how to decode complicated language will understand. I don't also believe that everything has to be important all of the time. You know, we could go through a century where poetry isn't important at all, and that's totally fine. I think that's totally fine. I don't think every form of art has to be important all the time. And Anthony Hayden Guest, who came to read at the opening, who I highly respect, he's an amazing writer. I did an interview with him for At Large magazine, and he actually brought this up where he said, you know, when I was your age, people in college, they weren't talking about TV shows and movies. They were talking about poetry and writing. Now you have people talking about TV shows and music and movies. They're not talking about writing. And that's fine. That's the medium people are using now because that's available to them. Why would you write poetry when you could make a Netflix show? There's no reason why every form of art has to be the most accessible, popular form of art at that point. If poetry needs to go through this thing where it's a, you know, elitist culture for a little while, so be it. What's the big deal?
Why did you want to include live readers for the launch of this book?
They were just people I liked, and it was selfish. And I wanted people whose work I respected to be there during my launch so I could hear them and think about how lucky I am that I know these people that I just respect their work immensely. I mean, Anthony as an example is just so incredible. Being able to see him perform live, if I could ask him for that favor, why wouldn't I ask that? It's just the greatest gift I could have as an artist is having someone like him or Rana perform at my book launch. It just felt like I was so lucky to be given that.
With these friendships and communities that you cultivate and that you experience, how much are you inspired by other poets, other readers, other writers? And do you ever have concern over being overly influenced by someone else's style? Does that ever play into your own potential loss of your own unique artistic poetic identity?
You know, I think that's a good question. I don't think that I'm ever afraid of being overly influenced by other people I work with. The biggest issue for me is the circle jerk of writers that occurs in every scene where it seems as if one hand washes the other and people either went to school together or started working on some zine together or wrote a free article for one another. And it turns into a circle jerk of, well, if I publish you, you'll publish me. And if I book you for this reading, you'll book me for this reading. And that's the thing I'm the most afraid of, because when you go to a bunch of readings, which I've done, you've done, and a lot of us have, you see a lot of horrible performances, really horrible. I mean, I'm trying to say that objectively as I can and in a way where I'm not trying to tell anyone they shouldn't write, but people performing too long, people making work that is fucking sexist or fucking racist, and not in a way like, oh, it's outwardly so, but like in a way where it's just like they've lived in this veil of privilege that they don't even know, and they're performing it out loud. And so when you see people whose work that really blows you away, you don't want to work with other people. you want to create these events that are open for all and entertaining and enlightening. And so what I try to avoid most of the time isn't that they're going to influence me, because they always inspire me, but I don't feel like I'm copying other people. What I try to avoid is still not opening myself to new people, because I'm afraid that they're not going to be as great as those that I've been working with. I think when you start doing that, you start to become the elitist person that you originally shunned.
For people who want to pick up a copy of Theomania, how can they do so?
So you can order it from Black Square Edition's website. You can order it from Hyperallergic. It's also on SPD. I think those are the three main channels. So just stick with that. It'll be on one of those.
Dallas Athan, thank you for being on Talking Paper.
Thank you.
For more about Dallas Athan, go to dallasathan.com. For more about Anti-Sentimental Society, go to blacksquareeditions.org. Now a selection of recorded readings from the launch event for Athan's new book of poetry, Theomania, which took place on April 30th, 2017, at the Jersey City studio of its artist, Maria Pavlovska, and featured live readings by Athan, writer, editor, and past Talking Paper interviewee Chris Campagnoni, Anti-Sentimental Society editor Ronna Lebo, Brooklyn writer and filmmaker Prospero Vega, and culture chronicler Anthony Hayden Guest. First, here is an excerpt from Campagnoni reading The Real Thing, parentheses, hashtag alternative facts.
Do people like me for me or for my outdoor space? Street easy sign on a bus stop asks the same question I more or less ask every day. Everybody would rather be anywhere else, as evidenced by everyone on their phones or in their phones as they wait for something to happen. On the street or on a date or in the bedroom. Lingerie ads all end or begin with the careful command, for him or for her. Some things are nice if you don't think about why. In Henry James's The Real Thing, things come in all forms and fashion. The practical thing, the sort of thing, like things, everything, things that appear, some things, a lot of things, anything, genuine, greasy, last century things, the first thing, the real thing, of course, the same thing, the long thing, the general thing, no thing, the only thing, the great things, the thing in the world I most hated, certain things, such things, for instance, the exact appearance of a hero, my little things, anything but the question of execution, sort of thing, I'd always represented myself to him as wishing to arrive at, a very good thing, a compendium of everything he most objected to in the social system of his country. Several things they never guessed, the wrong things, extraordinary things, the ideal thing, the only thing, that was clearly flattering. The real thing could be so much less precious than the unreal. Breakfast things, other things, agreeable things, and played them in an agreeable way. Hallowed things, the right thing, the things that had most shown him, everything fitted with a closeness that completed saved appearances. Many things, precious things, something like honor or kindness or justice, and a thing I do not wish to say any longer, except that I liked his voice as if I were somehow myself having the use of it.
Next, Ronna Lebo reads 9 Steps to Achieve Full Deniability.
1. Be a perfect participant. 2. Wave pale flags. 3. Carry the authority of complicated secrets. 4. Clang like a metal lock swinging in its socket. 5. Stagger back and forth until an action becomes clear. 6. Act as if occupied by gods. 7. Declare a state of pyromyalgia with quaint malice. 8. Proclaim kitsch prophecies. 9. Lie in a box, decently decayed by nature.
Next, Prospero Vega reads A Chinese Woman in the Rain.
Today, a Chinese woman ran across the back alley of the house I live in, here on the border of Bushwick and Ridgewood. She was running to avoid getting wet from a flash summer shower. I thought of Kurosawa films. There are no Japanese that live in Bushwick, of course, but this lady, I'm sure she was Chinese. However, something about the way she ran across my backyard, she was very elderly, you see, and across my field of vision made me remember Japan. I've never been to Japan, of course, but it reminded me of Japan. You see, you can develop nostalgia for places you've never lived in, especially in Bushwick. Many of the Dominican and Puerto Rican kids I grew up with here have never been to those islands, yet they are nostalgic for them. That's why you get them stitching their flags all over their clothes, their crazy stickers on their SUVs. I'm thinking of those stickers with the kids, you know, that take a piss on something, usually on a dog. Only Russian gangsters seem to have more tattoos or paraphernalia, or wear more pride on their bodies. The other night I ran into a kid I went to high school with. He sells DVDs at the bodega and the Chinese restaurant across the street, even in the laundromat occasionally. Everyone knows him by Jesus, and they tolerate him much in the same way, the same laissez-faire mode we tolerate the prostitutes on Star Street, or the thick, dead, steady stench of rabbit and pigeon fowl wafting through Trotman from El Pollo Mas Bueno, which is basically an abattoir. He is a minor force of nature, Jesus, and nature does not change, it merely passes by. Jesus does not speak Spanish, yet he refers to himself as Spanish, as do his black friends. They call him that Spanish from the DVDs. Jesus actually carries more Bollywood movies in Asian porn than anything made in Mexico or Spain. He has no idea who Guillermo del Toro is, who Pedro Almodóvar is, who Luis Buñuel is. His tastes more like Optimus Prime and the teenage coke sluts in the projects by the way. Jesus also has never been to Japan, but he and I can tell the difference between samurai films and kung fu films or anime. And I'll take anything, just about anything from him at all, that we might have in common, since I'm not into eating rabbits.
Finally, Anthony Hayden Guest reads Newscast.
So I'm sitting in a Starbucks listening to the blues, some peculiar enough for you, thinking about all the interesting news, wondering if it's a bit of true. Nostradamus knew a thing or two. The end of days is on its way. The sweet countdown begins today. Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, James Bond, Goldfinger, Dr. No. Those folk could really apply the target. Good and evil, toe to toe. But Holmes and Bond took out the fiends. Spider-Man, Batman, Fantastic Four. Pumping their muscles to the max in comic books and paperbacks. And on multiples of screens. Fight twisted masterminds galore and thwart their threatening attacks, the things will be as they've always been. But suddenly it's a different deal. Don't ask why, just when, where, how. Homeland in a documentary feel. A cop plan to make his wife a meal. Our new reel is the surreal. And this is some stuff that's coming in now. You're the whiz kid who hacked me. Great, what did you get? Up to your wazoo in problems and debt. The virus is turning your system to glue. You coughed. Ooh, looks like you're getting it too. So we're rebooting mammoths and their DNA to replace various species we're losing on the way. So the Tartar tiger, rhino, gorilla. I'll write a sad song when I need some filler. Sat next to a babe on a flight somewhere. Angry black eyes, or whoops, what a pair. Now I hear a scientist in one of the stands who's busy perfecting ingenious plans to make cute boobs that explode in midair. We began golfing in the polar zones, protected by robot killer drones. Car bombs are exploding all over the place. We must look like Party Planet from outer space. The end of days is well on its way, and that's my newscast for today.
That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.